There was then no man living who had sailed the Dragon's Run or seen it except the Archmage. 20 years before and more, he had sailed the length of it from east to west and back again. It was a nightmare and a marvel to a sailor. The water was a maze of blue channels and green shoals, and among these, by hand and word and most vigilant care, he and Arran now picked their boat's way between the rocks and reefs. Some of these lay low, under or half under the wash of the waves, covered with anemone and barnacle and ribbony sea fern. Like water monsters, shelled or sinuous. Others stood up in cliff and pinnacle, sheer from the sea, and these were arches and half-arches, carven towers, fantastic shapes of animals, boars' backs and serpents' heads, all huge, deformed, diffuse, as if life writhed half-conscious in the rock. The sea waves beat on them with a sound like breathing, and they were wet with the bright, bitter spray. In one such rock from the south, there was plainly visible the hunched shoulders and heavy, noble head of a man, stooped in pondering thought above the sea. But when the boat had passed it, looking back from the north, all man was gone from it, and the massive rocks revealed a cave in which the sea rose and fell, making a hollow, clapping thunder. There seemed to be a word, a syllable, in that sound. As they sailed on, the garbling echoes lessened, and this syllable came more clearly, so that Arran said, "Is there a voice in the cave?" "The sea's voice. But it speaks a word." Sparrowhawk listened. He glanced at Arran and back at the cave. "How do you hear it?" "As saying the sound Am." "In the old speech, that signifies the beginning, or long ago. But I hear it as Ob, which is a way of saying the end." "Look ahead there," he ended abruptly, even as Arran warned him. "Shoal water!" And though Lookfar picked her way like a cat among the dangers, they were busy with the steering for some while, and slowly the cave, forever thundering out its enigmatic word, fell behind them. Now, the water deepened, and they came out from among the phantasmagoria of the rocks. Ahead of them loomed an island like a tower. Its cliffs were black and made up of many cylinders or great pillars pressed together, with straight edges and plain surfaces, rising 300 feet sheer from the water. "That is the Keep of Kalesin," said the mage. "So the dragons named it to me when I was here long ago." "Who is Kalesin?" "The eldest." "Did he build this place?" "I do not know. I don't know if it was built, nor how old he is. I say he, but I do not even know that. To Kalesin, Orm Embar is like a yearling kid, and you and I are like mayflies." He scanned the terrific palisades, and Arran looked up at them uneasily, thinking how a dragon might drop from that far black rim and be upon them almost with its shadow. But no dragon came. They passed slowly through the still waters in the lee of the rock, hearing nothing but the whisper and clap of shadowed waves on the columns of basalt. The water here was deep, without reef or rock. Arran handled the boat, and Sparrowhawk stood up in the prow, searching the cliffs and the bright sky ahead. The boat passed out at last from the shadow of the Keep of Kalesin into the sunlight of late afternoon. They were across the Dragon's Run. The mage lifted his head like one who sees what he had looked to see, and across that great space of gold before them came on golden wings the dragon Orm Embar. Arran heard Sparrowhawk's cry to him, "Aro Kalesin?" He guessed the meaning of that, but could make no sense of what the dragon answered. Yet hearing the old speech, he felt always that he was on the point of understanding, almost understanding, as if it were a language he had forgotten, not one he had never known. In speaking it, the mage's voice was much clearer than when he spoke Hardic, and seemed to make a kind of silence about it, as does the softest touch on a great bell. But the dragon's voice was like a gong, both deep and shrill, or the hissing thrum of cymbals. Arryn watched his companion stand there in the narrow prow, speaking with the monstrous creature that hovered above him, filling half the sky. And a kind of rejoicing pride came into the boy's heart to see how small a thing a man is, how frail, and how terrible. For the dragon could have torn the man's head from his shoulders with one stroke of his taloned foot. He could have crushed and sunk the boat as a stone sinks a floating leaf, if it were only size that mattered. But Sparrowhawk was as dangerous as Orm Embar, and the dragon knew it. The mage turned his head. "Labannon," he said, and the boy got up and came forward, though he wanted to go not one step closer to those 15-foot jaws and the long, silt-pupiled, yellow-green eyes that burned upon him from the air. Sparrowhawk said nothing to him, but put a hand on his shoulder and spoke again to the dragon, briefly. "Labannon," said the vast voice with no passion in it. "Agni Labannon." He looked up. The pressure of the mage's hand reminded him, and he avoided the gaze of the green-gold eyes. He could not speak the old speech, but he was not dumb. "I greet thee, Orm Embar, Lord Dragon," he said clearly, as one prince greets another. Then there was a silence, and Arryn's heart beat hard and labored. But Sparrowhawk, standing by him, smiled. After that the dragon spoke again, and Sparrowhawk replied. And this seemed long to Arryn. At last it was over, suddenly. The dragon sprang aloft with a wing beat that all but heeled the boat over and was off. Arryn looked at the sun and found it seemed no nearer setting than before. The time had not really been long, but the mage's face was the color